Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. This morning, KUOW's Amy Rattle takes a look at a proposal to create a legal delivery option for marijuana in Seattle. Right now, illegal operations outnumber licensed stores. Correspondent Tom Bonsi talks with Professor Scott Mills about problems certain species may have adapting to climate and season changes. In the second half, we'll hear about two brothers who made a fateful traffic stop 9 years ago. Also in the second half, Coast Community Radio's own Kathleen Morgane talks to Chrissy Smith, the outreach coordinator for the Cape Falcon Reserve. But first, we take a look at demographic changes in Oregon. Oregon is becoming more diverse, and its residents and policies need to keep up with the changes, or risk many facets of life being unequal and unfair for 1 in 5 Oregonians. That's the finding of the new Face Race report released last week by a coalition of groups. It outlines priorities for the legislature to improve civil rights and criminal justice and boost fairness in the economy, education, and health care. Christina Nararian with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon hopes the overall message of the report extends beyond the halls of the state capitol.
And I think it's really a call to get to know the people in your area, just as it is for legislators to know their constituents. This is a shared experience, and that we all live in the state, and that we're all Oregonians, and that we should be invested in the success of each other.
The report compliments state lawmakers for drafting and passing legislation to help ensure racial equity. It examines 20 bills that affect communities of color, 17 of which passed, and lists votes by lawmaker on some of those measures. It asks for more specific data and accountability from the state to track problems, and one bill coming up in February would make Oregon the first state to restore the rights of residents who came here through the Compact of Free Association, or COFA, from some Pacific islands. David Antioch with the COFA Alliance National Network says they work, pay taxes, and join the military, but those who are low income can't pay for Medicaid.
This will bring in, you know, $9 from the federal to a $1 state money to help these folks and provide them this health care that they've been missing since 1996 after the Welfare Reform Act, and they've been banned completely from Medicaid.
There is a bipartisan support for the bill in Salem. The report calls 2015 a record year for racial equity. Antioch says that fits with most Oregonians' hopes for the future.
For our children to be able to go to school together and learn together and achieve an American dream together as Americans would be one thing out of this report that would be nice to see.
The report says if the state budget is to accurately reflect the priorities of the state, lawmakers must do better to fund state services and correct historic inequities. That said, Oregon is making progress covering more Hispanic children with health insurance, but there's a lot more to do, according to a new national report. The state managed to cover an additional 5,000 Latino children in the first year of the Affordable Care Act, but almost 12,000 remain uninsured. Linda Roman with the Oregon Latino Health Coalition says her group wants to see the state expand its basic health plan to cover more low-income families. In the meantime, she says the health insurance challenge is tougher for households with people of different immigration status.
One barrier is whether the whole family has health insurance. So mixed status families, it really creates a patchwork of coverage for each family member. And of course, none of us benefit when folks are uninsured or underinsured.
She adds that kids are much more likely to be covered when their parents are insured. The report from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families and the National Council of La Raza says Oregon is one of 11 states where the numbers and percentages of uninsured Hispanic children have fallen. While the gap is narrowing, Latino children are still 1.5 times less likely to have health coverage than other kids. Sonia Schwartz with the Georgetown Center says correcting that disparity is critical to improving kids' lives and even pulling families out of poverty.
Healthy children are healthy learners. We have some new research available, and it shows that health coverage for children is linked to better health throughout childhood, it's linked to school success, and it's linked to improved financial security for their families.
The report says outreach to families of color should be a priority. Schwartz says the majority of uninsured Hispanic children are U.S. citizens who are eligible for coverage through states' Medicaid or CHIP programs, but haven't been enrolled. Seattle officials say the city's 24 marijuana delivery businesses are illegal, but now on number it's 19 licensed stores. To combat the problem, Seattle officials are pledging a crackdown and a new legal delivery option. Amy Rattle has the report.
Alex Cooley is the co-founder of the marijuana producer Solstice. His business has been one of the first to receive state and city licenses, but he says businesses like his can't compete with illegal home delivery services.
If I were to be able to conduct a criminal enterprise where law enforcement doesn't care and my consumer does not care that it's illegal and they're breaking the law, what's going to stop me?
Solstice recently joined that competition, offering delivery for medical marijuana patients. Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes says he's dismayed that Solstice would take that step as a state-licensed business. Holmes says there are good reasons to offer delivery, but only if it's made legal first.
If we can make ourselves safer on the highways, if we can help adults who need access who can't otherwise get it, or people with medical authorizations, then it makes sense to do it within the legal regimen.
Seattle is asking legislators to approve a pilot program in which 5 licensed retailers would be permitted to offer home deliveries. Seth Dawson is with the Washington Association for Substance Abuse Prevention. At a recent legislative hearing, he said he's concerned that deliveries make youth access easier.
The deliverer may not have any idea that kids are present, and yet someone of age has been tapped to secure the marijuana.
The sponsor, Representative Christopher Hurst, agreed and said he inserted a provision that any store delivering to someone under 21 will lose their place in the pilot.
I wouldn't have even been slightly interested in this bill if it didn't come with a promise from Seattle that they were going to use this as part of the vehicle to shut down all the deliveries that are going on today.
Hurst said he's impressed with Seattle's efforts to close down unlicensed medical marijuana stores. Seattle officials are promising a similar crackdown on illegal delivery businesses, using civil and criminal penalties. I'm Amy Radel reporting.
The rules for fashion, color, and season have changed a lot since your grandma's day. Black in July, white after Labor Day? No longer a faux pas if you wear the wrong color for the season. For certain species in the animal world, the consequences can be fatal when it comes to wrongly matched colors. Tom Bonsi reports on researchers who are studying snowshoe hares in the Northwest against the backdrop of climate change.
Professor Scott Mills compares snowshoe hares to the ice cream cone of the forest.
My carnivorous graduate student likes to call them the cheeseburgers of the forest, meaning that they're eaten by pretty much every predator out there.
Mills says camouflage is the hare's most important survival tool. The typical wild hare sheds its brown coat and changes to white in winter to blend in with the snow. Now remember, though, warm winters like we had last year, how that could be a harbinger of the future under climate change. Mills and his team from the University of Montana and North Carolina State wondered about the snowshoe hares running around in white against brown backdrops. The research team tracked nearly 200 snowshoe hares in Montana with radio collars over 3 years.
We find that the cost of being mismatched is substantial. Every week that a hare is mismatched, it has a 7% lower chance of surviving than a hare that's not mismatched.
Mills says if there's any hopeful news here, it's that hares display wide variation in the timing of their coat color molt. So the next question is whether through natural selection and evolution, the animals can adjust to decreasing winter. Case in point, hares on Washington's Olympic Peninsula and along the Oregon coast have evolved to stay brown all winter. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Professor Mills observed that scientists used to think about evolution as being something that happened over geologic time. But biologists in the last 20 or 30 years have been stunned by how rapid, meaningful evolutionary change can take place. Mills is a co-author on the study published last week in the peer-reviewed journal Ecology Letters. The team is expanding its work globally to other species that change coat color seasonally. Along with weasels and jack-tailed rabbits, the team is studying Arctic foxes in Sweden and mountain hares in Scotland and Ireland. Since Mill relocated from Missoula to Raleigh in 2013, he has overseen the construction of a state-of-the-art research facility, which includes several light and temperature-controlled chambers dubbed phenotrons. One of these chambers is now populated by about a dozen hares captured in the woods outside Skokomish, Washington, and the other contains a similar number of snowshoe hares from Montana. The chambers are currently set to mimic the daylight and temperature conditions of the critters' home ranges. Until now, field observations have suggested the hares don't modify their behavior much to reduce their vulnerability when their natural fur camouflage misaligns with snow duration. Snowshoe hares are widely distributed across the northern tier of the United States. They can be found throughout the northern Rockies, the Cascade Range from Canada to central California, as well as in coastal forests of Oregon and Washington. You're listening to The Bridge. Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife formally acknowledged last week that it violated the constitutional rights of two brothers who commercially fished the Columbia River. The agency's admission of wrongdoing is part of a settlement in a lawsuit that has changed agency practices. It stems from a traffic stop nearly 9 years ago in rural southwest Washington. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has the story.
The traffic stop happened on the morning of March 23, 2007. The location was tiny Wakayakum County across the Columbia River from Astoria. It was captured on video.
Now film this guy too.
Filming from inside a crew cab pickup truck was the Tarabakia family, father Joe, 20-year-old son Matthew, and 17-year-old twins Alex and Brian. Outside the truck were several officers from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. They demand that the Tarabakias get out of the vehicle. The family refuses to budge until the county sheriff or undersheriff show up.
Okay, when the undersheriff gets here, just hold on.
Gets here, I'll step out.
This roadside standoff followed a morning of fishing in the Columbia. The Tarabakias had a load of salmon the fish cops wanted to inspect. The family had led officers on a slow-speed chase before they were finally boxed in. These officers and the Tarabakias knew each other well. There was a lot of history and bad blood between them. Now it was coming to a head.
The
standoff lasted more than 13 minutes. At one point in the video, a Fish and Wildlife captain is seen pulling out a collapsible baton. He says he'll break the window if they don't get out. It ends when the undersheriff arrives, someone the Tarabakias trusted. They unlock the doors to the truck. The officers quickly detain the family.
Just film it, Brian.
You, out. Drop it. Just relax.
Driver Matthew Tarabakia and his father Joe were jailed for resisting arrest and obstruction. Those charges were later dismissed. The fish the Tarabakias were transporting that day were all legal. In 2010, the Tarabakias filed a federal lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the traffic stop. The family argued the Fish and Wildlife officers had no right to pull them over to do a fish check without reason to believe a crime had been committed. They lost in U.S. District Court, but successfully appealed to the Ninth Circuit. Matthew says the appellate decision on their Fourth Amendment claim was vindicating, especially after what the family calls a campaign of harassment by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife.
No one believes you when you say the police did something unfair to you. When you say that, people automatically assume that you did something wrong and you're just trying to cover it up.
The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife denies it targeted the Tarabakias. Steve Crown is the current chief of the agency's law enforcement division. He says regular contact with fish police is part and parcel of being a commercial fisherman.
It is common knowledge amongst commercial fishermen that they're going to be inspected. There's high dollars, high stakes. When you're engaged in a commercial fishing practices, you can have huge impacts on a particular species of fish, and they know that.
But Crown says as a result of this case, his officers have ended a long-standing practice of pulling vehicles over on the road for fish checks.
We've told our officers that, hey, don't make those type of traffic stops unless you have reasonable suspicion to do so.
Officers can still do those checks on the water and at the landing area. The Tarabakias recently settled their lawsuit against the agency for $130,000. In addition to the payment, Fish and Wildlife agreed to acknowledge it violated Matthew and Alex's rights. For technical reasons, they were the only family members named in the appeal to the Ninth Circuit. Many years have passed since that roadside standoff in Wakayakum County. The Fish and Wildlife captain in the video is now a deputy chief. The Tarabakia family is no longer in the fishing business. The boys moved away. Alex doesn't think he'll come back.
I'm not sure I would go home. I feel, to some extent, like my name and my family's name is kind of tarnished, and sort of like there's a stigma around it to where I'm not sure that I would ever have like kind of an even playing field.
Even though he would be coming home as a doctor, Alex is currently attending medical school at Dartmouth in New Hampshire as a rural health scholar. Matthew is also in med school at Harvard. Alex says he always knew he would go into medicine, but Matthew says what happened between his family and the authorities on the Columbia River influenced his decision to leave the fishing business behind. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
You're listening to The Bridge. The Cape Falcon Marine Reserve was officially designated on January 1st. The 12.4 square mile reserve is located in the ocean just off the northern Oregon coast between Falcon Cove and Manzanita. The new reserve is dedicated to research into ocean wildlife. In our final feature, Coast Community Radio's Kathleen Morgane spoke earlier with Chrissy Smith, the outreach coordinator for the Cape Falcon Reserve. Chrissy began the conversation with a description of just what a marine reserve is.
A marine reserve is an area that's set aside and designated for conservation and scientific research. Marine reserve sites in Oregon are usually composed of both marine reserves and marine protected areas, and those two things are similar but slightly different. Marine reserves are areas of no take, so no living animal or plant can be removed from an area, and there's also all ocean development is prohibited, so things like wave energy, for instance, could not happen inside a marine reserve. Marine protected areas are similar. There's also restrictions on what can be removed, but there's typically exceptions, usually around fishing or crabbing. Almost all of the marine reserve sites in Oregon have both of these marine reserve areas of no take and then adjacent marine protected areas. And Cape Falcon is the same.
And who provides oversight?
All of the marine reserves are managed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And when it comes down to, and right now our goal is just educating everybody about the marine reserves, but when it comes down to the point of enforcement, that goes to the Oregon State Police.
And your organization's role, could you describe that?
Sure. As the Friends of Cape Falcon Marine Reserve is a group of local nonprofit partners as well as local citizens. And our core goal is to help build people's understanding of the Cape Falcon Marine Reserve site and appreciation of it. We really just want to help people understand that it's there, that it recently went into effect, why it's unique, and then help people learn about marine reserves and the benefits that they can provide to the environment.
Is there any specific research or plan for the Cape Falcon location?
All of the Oregon Marine Reserve sites have a robust monitoring plan that's been set up by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and more information can be found about that on their website, which is www.oregonocean.info, and you just click on the Marine Reserve tab. But our Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife have set up a plan for each of the Marine Reserve sites, including Cape Falcon, where they will monitor out in the ocean environment in terms of, you know, what kind of species are there, what kind of fish and plants and invertebrates, and which type of habitats are found here before implementation. So before the reserve goes to effect, and then periodically after it goes to effect, so that we can see how things are changing over time in each of the reserves. And they also have set up, they will do that inside each of the marine reserve sites in Oregon. They also have designated areas that are as compatible as possible, so they can compare it to an area that is that doesn't have the Marine Reserve protection around it.
Are there any volunteer opportunities at the Cape Falcon Reserve?
There is an abundance of volunteer opportunities with our group, with the Friends of group, and a number of different partnering agencies that we work with. We want to collect as much information about Cape Falcon as possible, and there's a number of really great citizen science projects that are getting up and running in our area. There is just some new funding to do some seabird monitoring program that we'll be looking for volunteers that would like to help us monitor for different seabird use in the Marine Reserve. We are looking for people to help us with monitoring marine debris, sea star wasting syndrome, as well as a number of other surveys that will look at the diversity of rookie intertidal creatures. Anybody who wants to get involved with any of those kind of things can just contact me, and I will get you in touch with the right people so that we can get you involved. There's also just being part of our friends group to help us develop different events to get people out into the reserve, viewing the reserve, appreciating the reserve, and learning about the reserve is also an option. And we have a group of core, motivated, energetic volunteers that meet the third Friday of every month. So anybody who would like to get involved and help us plan hikes on the land, beach walks, things like that can join us at those meetings and help us scope out some great ways to get people engaged with the Marine Reserve.
Well, it sounds like you have the first of those events planned for Saturday.
That's right. And so as a way just to kind of kick off Cape Falcon going into effect, we're hosting two parties this month. Our first one happened in Manzanita approximately 2 weeks ago and was a great, really fun event. What was well attended, and we're having a second event in Cannon Beach this Saturday from 4:30 to 8 at the Chamber Community Hall in Cannon Beach. It's going to be a lot of fun. We have free food from the Warren House Pub. We have beer from DeGard Brewing in Tillamook and Fort George Brewery in Astoria. We have Two Crows Joy playing, and if you haven't heard them, they've got a great sound. We have fun activities for kids of all ages that can come out and fish print with us and take home your own fish print. And then we also, of course, have lots of information about the Marine Reserve. So it's a great event to come out and meet the community team and the Friends of group and a lot of other key people with the reserve, learn a little bit about the reserve while listening to great music and having great food and beverage. It went off well a couple weeks ago, and we expect to have another great event this weekend.
And is there anything else you'd like to add?
I just want to add that we also are co-sponsoring a number of informative presentations in February. One, it will be on marine reserves and marine mammals that we're presenting with the Haystack Rock Awareness Program Speaker Series. That's on February 10th in Cannon Beach. We're also co-hosting a seabird and marine reserves presentation with the Lower Nahalem Watershed Council. And that event will be on Thursday, February 11th at 6:30 at the Pine Grove in Manzanita. And then for folks in Portland, the Lower Nahalem Community Trust is presenting the Natural Wonders of Oregon's Cape Falcon Marine Reserve with presenters from the Audubon Society, Surf Rider Foundation, and the Nature Conservancy to talk about different ways to get involved in the Marine Reserve and just kind of the basics behind Marine Reserves and Cape Falcon. And if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they can connect with me via our Facebook page. It's www.facebook.com/CapeFalconMR. Or you can email me at capefalconmr@gmail.com.
Well, thank you very much, Chrissy Smith.
Oregon has designated 5 Marine Reserve sites. The other sites are located at Cascade Head near Lincoln City, Otter Rock near Newport, Cape Perpetua near Yahats, and Redfish Rocks near Port Orford. The Cape Falcon Marine Reserve designation will last until the year 2023, when the state of Oregon will reevaluate the program. Again, Saturday's event will take place in Cannon Beach from 4:30 to 8 p.m. at the Cannon Beach Community Hall, and that's at 207 North Spruce Street. I'm Kathleen Morgane reporting.
This morning we say goodbye to friend and colleague Dr. Ann Goldine. Ann was a programmer and volunteer here at Coast Community Radio. We were blessed by her curiosity, her passion, her humor, and her boundless energy. On behalf of the volunteers, the staff, and the board here at Tillicum House, we offer our sincere condolences to her family and many, many friends. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge.